Today's featured guest, Dr. Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity. It's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Chris Martinson to the show, author of a new book, Prosper, How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting, as well as the head of peakprosperity.com. That's all one word, peakprosperity.com. Welcome back, Dr. Martinson.
Well, it's very nice to be back with you today. We're really approaching not just a cyclical end game, but really something much larger. We're in the end game stage, as I consider, of a fiat money experiment, really born on August 15, 1971, when the world decided to abandon gold as a tether, and we became untethered. And so what happened since? Well, we fell into this fantasy that debt could, and increasing debt could replace savings and true prosperity. We've been borrowing at twice the rate of underlying income growth, we meaning the whole world, really, China catching up, you know, like gangbusters in the last few years, but the United States led the way. And we led the way on this really unfortunate idea that somehow we could borrow money at twice the rate our income was growing. Bad idea. We had a warning shot in 2008, decided as a nation and as a world that we're going to double down on that particular bet, get the quote-unquote credit markets repaired, which just meant transitioning unsustainable borrowing from the private sector to the public sphere. And so here we are. To sustain that fantasy, that illusion, requires over $10 trillion of negative interest rates in the world right now, continued central bank interventions, which are increasing in severity and frequency. And all of this has led to people, rightly, feeling really anxious, concerned, and confused if they're not paying attention, and downright frightened if they are.
We have some very bright listeners, not pandering to the audience, but simply, it's just true. I mean, I've had the pleasure now for over a decade and to correspond with many of our listeners, phone calls, etc., very successful in their areas, their field, because there seems to be a convergence or a confluence of interest in economics as people mature, for obvious reasons. And as we look at this dilemma, we've been in the blogosphere and around the internet for so long. We have had this, the sky is falling ideology since the year 2000. I think people have reached a point where the level of negativity, which obviously sells newsletters and sells books and sells tapes and audio and CDs and, you know, makes catchy website names, but it sells, and that brings in revenues and it brings in advertisers and things of that nature. Why is this time different?
I certainly am very sympathetic to the idea of crisis fatigue. I suffered from it myself. This is all stretched out far, far too long. Listen, for people who are alert and paying attention, it's enormously frustrating to see something that's wrong, it's obviously wrong, and yet it persists. And we might even notice that in this particular election cycle, for anybody who wants to look at it, it is clear and obvious that there is fraud and rigging and vote miscounting happening with electronic tally machines, absolutely statistically churning out results that are impossible, and yet it persists. You would think something as fundamental, as important, with two equally matched sides, both interested in getting the, you know, the result they want, that somehow this would be brought to light, but it persists. And Jesse Livermore said it way back in the 30s, which is, the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And that's the basic idea, and it's not just markets, it's that the human condition allows us to exist in a state of denial for a really long time. Not in a healthy way either. That denial, of course, leads us further down the path. So this time, to me, is going to be different. This is going to be a very long topping process, making a very large stop, because, Chris, this is the mother of all bubbles. This is the sovereign credit bubble.
I like the idea there of crisis fatigue. We were early on the trend, the 2008-2009 crisis, the financial crisis, the credit crisis, what some people refer to as the Great Recession, which I think is a pretty apt moniker. I mean, without somewhere between $700 million and $3 trillion in just U.S. bailouts, we've heard numbers tossed out there as much as $10 to $12 trillion that the Fed gave to the European Union just to help keep it afloat so it didn't sink us. A massive amount of monetary stimulus and QE operations for decades now. Coordinated efforts among the three top central bankers at least to keep the Titanic from sinking. And I think what you're saying is, well, you know, all they did was plug the hole, and inevitably the ship must right itself or capsize.
Well, absolutely. If we back up just two big steps, we say this is all a giant math problem. At the highest level, and this is something I've talked with economists about, and I just personally interviewed Rana Faruhar, the managing editor of Time, their economics correspondent, who wrote a great book called Makers and Takers. And I posed her this question because she's got great access to you know, very high-level people. And I said, if we take the idea that our economy and our money system is requiring infinite growth on a finite planet, is anybody talking about that? And she thought it was a great question and said, no, it's everybody, you know, could clearly work out that that's a big giant thing. That's an issue we need to think about, but we're not doing it. And so when you ask me, is this, you know, what's it going to take and how bad could this be? In my mind, this is going to be really bad, because once enough people figure out that there are hundreds of trillions of dollars of claims on an economy that can no longer grow for a variety of demographic, structural, resource-based, and debt-based reasons. It's this big, giant, swirling cauldron of reasons. Once enough people work that out, you know, the next question is, well, where do they go with their hundreds of trillions of paper claims? And the answer is they try and all squeeze out through some very, very small doorways, which would be called real assets or hard productive assets or productive enterprises. And I think we're going to see a real scramble at some point in the future, and it'll be messy, and it'll be chaotic. And I think we'll discover that having high-frequency trading platforms out there that can operate in a millisecond is a bad thing, not a good thing.
Maybe that's a subject for another episode, because I was heavily involved with extremely high-frequency trading through the Forex market using robotic algorithms and MetaTrader and whatnot. Published that online, you know, an average of 89 to 93% win rate over 600 documented trades through ZuluTrade. I question maybe some of the hype surrounding that, and although there's been, some interesting research in the area, maybe it's the high-frequency trading through much larger institutions, not individuals. What I really wanted to get to, the swirling cauldron, as you call it, or let's call it a downward vortex, perhaps. The coordinated efforts of these individuals have magically been able to keep the edifice from imploding. Huge inflows that have obviously been a major component, other than obviously buybacks and things of that nature, of our stock market rally since 2009. This was not fomented by the Fed alone. Huge inflows from troubled areas around the world. Could there be more than just economics at play? Could it be that we're viewed as the least sick in the ward?
Well, no, are we the least sick patient in the ward here in the United States? We still, believe it or not, are one of the least corrupt places, one of the places that you could actually move capital and have the most confidence that, you know, you'll be able to keep it there. So that explains a huge amount of the global capital flows that have been transpiring. Obviously, China's been a huge engine of capital formation, not least of which is because they've piled on $20+ trillion of debt in just the last 8 years, and that creates money. They got siphoned, and some of it was real value creation, and some was usual financialization spin-off profits. And those have been circling the globe looking for a place to be safe, because the people in China rightly do not trust how their own country is going to behave in a big correction of some kind, which everybody knows is coming. We don't know when. But yes, the tricks that the powers that be can pull off are huge. And in the United States, there's been no accountability for anybody at any level who's operating in the financial sphere. It's kind of like the untouchables of times past. I would greatly love to see an actual, true, and complete audit of the Fed, just to find out, what have they been up to? I'm supposed to trust that their balance sheet is fair, free, and complete. I don't trust that. And so we've seen the central banks of the world pass this baton from one to the next, from, you know, United States Federal Reserve to the Bank of Japan, over to the ECB, back to the Fed, and now back to the ECB in the form of €85 billion a month. The ECB is buying corporate bonds now. That is just it's an incredible flood of money, and it's hugely distorting, and it's at least part of the explanation for why we see money flooding anywhere, somewhere into the U.S. stock market, helping to power it higher.
I don't want to say it's a bleak scenario, because I know there's light at the end of this tunnel. Help us see just how we can prepare our families, our communities, and our nation for what you see coming.
Well, certainly. I think the prescription is the same at all different levels. It's fractal, so it applies everywhere. And the first thing is you have to be prepared for the idea that there will be a large debt deflation coming. We have all this debt. It's outstanding. The question isn't, can it be paid back? The only question remaining is who's going to take the losses. So either it gets defaulted on or there's haircuts or something has to happen. But at any rate, when we get into a debt deflation, if you're an individual and you're owning lots of non-productive debt, like you're carrying a mortgage that's right at the edge of your capability to afford given your paycheck, debt's a stone-cold killer in a deflation. I think that everything that the central banks have tried to do has not ignited the kind of inflation that would actually be beneficial. They always say they want inflation like it's just generally beneficial. It's not true. You want wage inflation, that helps. Having my healthcare costs go up, that doesn't help. So they're trying to ignite this inflation. They've been unsuccessful. Negative interest rates have actually made the process worse, not better. They haven't figured that out yet, but they will. And so at this point, I would say people should be out of debt as much as possible. You should absolutely have some gold and silver, but mostly gold at this stage as a form of insurance against a monetary accident. There will be one of those in the future if we don't get off of this credit train. And then to build cash reserves, because what you want to do is be ready for the bargains that are coming. I'm not of the view that you know, this is one final vortex of suckage to the bottom. I think we've got many more cycles in front of us. They will be painful, but this is going to be an extremely painful cycle. So having no debt or low debt, cash and gold is a good position to be in. This is a very defensive strategy, but I don't see that the upside potential here is all that good.
I think that the scenario you've outlined here is much more realistic. Okay, we had a 2008-2009. We might see something similar. We might see something worse, but it's inevitable. And of course, they will, you know, do everything they can to keep cogs spinning, but eventually the end game might not be next year. It might be 20, 30 years down the road. There's just too many variables in this multivariate problem. So we're going to skip that and just say, look, okay, we see a trend, a theme, a bias unfolding within the economic data. It sounds like a positive for the energy sector, which was battered over the past several years. And that all came to a crescendo with oil under $30 a barrel for a very brief period of time. Since then, you know, we've been bouncing around 50, which is a remarkable recovery.
50 is wonderful compared to 28, but it's still not enough to support nearly all of the shale plays. And by which I mean, if you looked at all of the territory in the Bakken or the Eagle Ford or the Woodford or any of the shale plays, some very small select percentage of those plays in terms of footprint would make sense at 50 because those are the ultra sweet spots. But it turns out maybe 90% of those plays do not make sense at this price. So that's part one. Part two, none of the deep water plays make sense at anything less than 100. So those are our new marginal forms of oil creation and development. Those are offline right now. The world is chugging along on the oil finds that we invested in a while back. We know that we've had a huge shortfall in capital expenditures on upstream development in 2014, 15, and now 16. So those holes in CapEx are going to create future holes in supply. What does the price have to be in order to support new supply coming online? Well, 80 or higher. I think 100 makes a lot more sense. So we're going to have to see higher oil prices in the future. You know, whether a world awash in $200-plus trillion in debt likes high oil prices, that's a different question. But more microscopically, I think the energy space has nowhere to go but up. But it still could have, Chris, some rocky points between here and there, particularly if this global slowdown that we're tracking right now really takes hold. That could really punish the demand side of this story. It's a possibility. I don't think it's clear sailing yet.
Move back to the precious metals. Obviously, there are so many ways that we can analyze the precious metals and the prospects on a forward basis. Clearly, you are looking for better times ahead. Are there more important or coincidental metrics that help craft this idea of a solid bull trend unfolding in the precious metals?
I am not even remotely an investor in gold and silver at this point because of inflation. That's not anywhere on my radar screen, and it really hasn't been. The correlation between gold and inflation is kind of poor. In the United States and more generally globally, few local places it's done well. If you looked at Venezuela or Zimbabwe, but that's really just tracking the dollar as well. So you would have done as well in those as gold and as being in the dollar when those hyperinflations were happening. Could people start thinking of it as an inflation hedge? Maybe. The reason I love gold and I'm really heavily invested in it is because it's my insurance policy against what I consider to be an inevitable financial disaster, a really big accident, something worse than 2008 by far. This could include sovereign defaults. There's going to be more institutional defaults. As we mentioned before, there's just an enormous pile of losses that have to be recognized. It'll just be a scramble to figure out who's going to eat them. With derivatives, we can't really know. And the one thing I love is how gold behaves in moments of financial uncertainty where nobody knows who owes whom what. And that's what's coming. And I think that gold is going to do well, particularly in a deflationary environment, because of that uncertainty factor, because it still counts as tier one capital, because let's face it, gold is money. You know, even Greenspan says that now, and now more recently, Mervyn King. I mean, we've got all these ex-central bankers, once they go into retirement, suddenly speaking the truth.
Former Fed head Alan Greenspan's recent comments, which are really mind-boggling to hear this level-headed intellectual PhD in economics even think about the idea of martial law coming to the United States compared us to Venezuela. I mean, obviously, you need to crystallize any wealth that's remaining. This is against the backdrop of a country where something like 80% of the inhabitants of the U.S. can't even put together $400 for an emergency check. I don't say that glibly, paycheck to paycheck. And ironically, even though they're able-bodied or of sound mind, body, and age classified as viable workers, they cannot find jobs. And those that have found jobs are underemployed, which, as I think Robert Kiyosaki also pointed out so well, tends to lead to unemployability on a forward basis. And with 25 to 35-year-olds, the millennials now, overwhelmingly living at home in their parents' basements, and that just erodes the potential for house purchases and families down the road, unlike the baby boomer generation, which, was the backbone. So if I understand you correctly, you're less concerned about inflation, which we've obviously seen lately, although, of course, the greenback suffering sharply here. You're really more interested in the systemic risk, and there's a lot of nervousness around the world in this race to the bottom. Do you care to give people an idea of just how, a bull market in the yellow metal will unfold this time, and whether or not you think shares, which are essentially leveraged play on the metals, could fare?
Well, the shares, to start there, they could fare very well, obviously. That's always a possibility. I, like many people, have been soundly disappointed by the ability of many of the gold companies to properly manage their free cash flows and to generate free cash flows during a rising price for their underlying metal. So I think, you need to pick those shares carefully. I really believe in due diligence. There are a lot of good companies, great companies, and dodgy ones in the space, just like any space. So I like to be picky about which ones I like to really look at. And then the way I'm really thinking, here everybody's tracking gold in dollars right now. How many dollars is it per ounce? Eventually that flips, and people start thinking, well, wait a minute, how many ounces per dollar? And then eventually we get to decouple from that, and people go, well, forget dollars, because those are those are gyrating all over the place. This is my key metric, and the reason I accumulated gold was that I said to myself, look, when I can trade an ounce of gold for an acre of productive land, I'll start making that trade and swapping away from gold back into something productive. I think that when the dust settles from this, and that could be 10 years from now, could be 100 years, could be 2 years, I don't know, but when the dust settles, people once again realize that paper money, stocks, bonds, all those things, those aren't real wealth. Those are claims on wealth. What's real wealth? It's real things. It's things that take actual energy, actual effort to produce, or they're productive enterprises. It's good farmland. It's timberland with value. It's really productive real estate of some kind. It's the means of production, whether that's small or medium-sized businesses, large businesses, that have access to the resources they need to do what they do. Those are the true engines of wealth. We've just forgotten and got wandered away from that and believe that capital formation is something that can be printed out of thin air. Like, that's what the Federal Reserve has been trying to do. The efforts they went to preserve capitalism, and I would note ironically that they've kind of said in order to save the baby, we have to kill it. Because what's been practiced these last I don't know, 7 years now in this so-called Great Recovery from the Great Recession has been anything but capitalism, which is real people, real enterprises creating real value, taking the excess surplus of those efforts and plowing that back into productive investments. That whole machine has been broken. Corporations have been doing share buybacks, which is financial engineering. They have not been plowing back into R&D, property, plant, and equipment, and CapEx, things like that. We've had financial speculation running amok. We've had very little investment in the future in terms in this country in terms of actual infrastructure, real changes to education that are meaningful, et cetera, and so on. So it's all kind of just been papering over. You said plug the hole in the Titanic. It's really, yeah, they just papered over the hole and crossed their fingers and hoped magically that we'd get this, you know, turnaround like we've always had in history, and they've been confused because they were looking at the wrong stuff. They fundamentally didn't understand what they were up to. And negative interest rates are just absolutely, even within their own sphere of study, they didn't understand psychologically what a negative interest rate really means.
I mean, if we look at Barsky and Summers, you know, negative interest rates, put it this way, the impetus behind a strong gold bull markets. And keep in mind, I'm talking about negative real rates of return, which is a little different than negative interest rates. But still, I mean, that's what you wind up with when you have a negative interest rate, and even further into negative territory. We're almost victims of our own success in the United States. So let's say the West in general. We've had prosperity and stability within our political, for the most part, and economic system, but had a solid basis that we've forgotten what it's like to have, you know, a worst of all worlds, Venezuela style implosion in our economy. That's where your idea of I won't trade an ounce of this precious metal until its purchasing power is truly reestablished. In order for that to occur, it's going to take an entirely new mindset.
Let me just plug the book Prosper for a second, because we have eight ideas of capital formation for people in there. Finance is just one of them. We've covered finance today. Gold and silver and all those other things show up in that chapter. But we want to point people to the idea that in these really uncertain times, that there are other forms of capital that are going to be extremely important for you to have, including living capital, which is your own health. Of course, everything starts with that. You have nothing if you don't have your health. So living capital is very important. I'm looking out at my garden and orchard right now, which is another expression of living capital. Social capital, very important. Emotional capital, extremely important. Are you going to be a person who thrives or falls apart when the chips are down? These are a few examples of some of these other areas of capital. Very, very important. Some of them you can buy, some can't. But somebody who wants to truly be resilient, really wants to both be prepared for the future, but really living into today more fully, that's what the book is about. Financial capital is just one part. We say, take care of that right up front. Here are the other areas to look at. And if you enhance these, your life will be better today. You'll be healthier. You'll be happier. You'll be more well-connected. And if the future goes this way, you will be in a position to be helpful to other people, not somebody needing help, as well as having access to fresh food. And so I don't see it as work. I see it as a really healthy hobby and a practice for me. And it's meditative, too. I really find it soothing on many levels. But, you know, for somebody who's saying, yeah, I don't know, and it sounds hard and it sounds expensive, you know, the simplest thing you can do is you can go to Home Depot, you can buy a bag of topsoil. It'll be about $3 to $5, depending on what day you buy it on. And you can throw that right on your lawn, unopened, flat, and you can cut a slit in it, and you can put a potato in there. And cut a slit on the bottom, too, so it can get its roots out. You don't have to dig up any grass, which is a chore. You don't have to do anything. Just throw it down. And the next thing you know, you will be connected to your food production, because this potato will grow if you put it in the sun where it should be, not in the shade. And it's very easy to get started. I got my own garden started using what's called the lasagna method, where we put down layers of cardboard first. I didn't have to dig up grass. I did that for many years, you know, even rototilling, hard work. You just put the cardboard down, it kills the grass, and you just layer stuff right on top of that, leaves, compost, soil, if you want to buy that and put it on, and just start from there. So, yeah, the work involved, which some people will see as a barrier, can be minimized if you're smart about it. But once you get connected to the rhythm of growing your own food and eating your own food, I think most people, once they try it, get addicted to it, because it's soothing on so many levels.
it's not just for spring anymore. I mean, people think, well, you grow a garden in the spring or the summer. You can have wonderful winter crops. And in fact, to protect that topsoil that you've worked so hard to cultivate, winter kales, garlic grows primarily over the winter season, maybe harvesting some along the way, enriches the soil. And you're recognizing that as we give to, you know, the environment provides for us. And there are some lessons in here that I think transcend even into the investing world. If I do a good job investing with seed capital, if you will, I might wind up with many, many fold what I began with.
There are lots of approaches to doing the gardening piece. Just give it a try and get started. And I think really honestly, Chris, it's the reconnection to nature. It's the reconnection to the growth cycles. It's something we've lost. And I've just seen so many people find it, I use the word soothing, but I'll even say go further and say it has rescued some people because we need that natural connection. Gardening is an easy way to get started.
And I would just point out that some of the top research in this area, Linus Pauling, Max Gershon, and some of the favorites that you and I have discussed, we won't get into that today, agree that that natural sunlight, the fresh air, healthy exercise, you don't have to buy a $1,500 rototiller, for instance. I mean, God bless you if you have one, that's great. You can get a $79 electric one delivered to your door from Amazon. But I would even argue, as you said, you don't need to do that. We don't need to tear up Mother Nature by simply using square foot gardening. You break down some cardboard boxes laying around the garage, if you will, or in the crawl space. And of course, that stops weed production and growth. Layer in this year, if you like, grass clippings or leaves that were piled up in fall. Let worms and insects, and more importantly, fungi, do the work for you. By the end of fall or maybe spring, you're going to have great soil to work with. This is Gold Seek. This is not Garden Seek. I'm sure our listeners, some of them, will appreciate this. And if we just convince one listener to put in a garden and increase, you know, health capital, that's a positive. Dr. Chris Martinson, it's always a pleasure. Please tell folks more about Prosper as well as Peak Prosperity.
Sure. I have a couple of books out. One of them is Prosper, co-authored with Adam Taggart, available on Amazon, also at our site, peakprosperity.com. And The Crash Course is the first book that I came out with. It's also a video series, very instructive for people who want to know why we are where we are today. And hopefully that gives some explanatory power and has some predictive power. Thank you so much.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.